fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. On average, we spend one quarter to a third of our lives asleep. But what exactly happens when your head hits the pillow? Before the 1950s, most people believed that sleep was just a passive activity that left our brains and bodies dormant. But it turns out that sleep is a period during which the brain is engaged in multiple activities that aren't just necessary to a healthy life. They're closely linked to quality of life. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Researchers are spending many of their waking hours trying to learn more about sleep processes and how they affect mental and physical health. Today, we take a glimpse into the powerful and often surprising findings of sleep researchers. We'll talk about what happens in the brain during sleep, what happens during a sleep study, and what the results of those studies can signal about our overall physical and emotional health. Joining us today is Tonda Nicholson, a polysomnographic technologist from Aspirus Healthcare, to share her expertise with us. Tonda, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
You can join the conversation, too, by calling us at 800-780-9742. You can email us, too, at route51@wpr.org. When emailing, be sure to include your first name and your city of residence. Callers, please allow plenty of time for our producer to answer your call. So I'd like to start by asking you about your job title. What exactly is a polysomnographic technologist? That is a mouthful.
It is, and it's a hard one to say. Anyway, it's just specializing in sleep disorders and taking care of patients, monitoring patients, analyzing them while they're sleeping, and preparing the report for the sleep physician, the sleep specialist, our medical director, to make recommendations to your physician on how to treat what's happening to you, because there's multiple sleep disorders. So there's going to be different recommendations.
So you've been in sleep medicine for a long time, several decades. How did you get into it?
You know, it was very fascinating because I was in the 80s. I went to school to be a registered respiratory therapist, which I did get my credentials. I am registered. And when I would recover open heart surgery patients, this was my first key to something's going on here. And we would recover open heart patients after they've been reversed and we're trying to get them awake, you know, after surgery. We could not keep people breathing, you know, and they would do this gasping, you know, and then just real fast, deep breathing. And then all of a sudden stop breathing again. And I remember asking the nurses in the unit, have we reversed him yet? You know, from the anesthesia, they're like, yeah. So I started asking physicians and just researching, why is sleep apnea such a problem? And then I had physicians say, well, we learn anywhere from 1% to 11% maximum of our training. Now, this is back then, way back then, on sleep. So through the years, you can see how it's progressed. Now we've got fellowships in sleep for physicians. They specialize in it. So basically that was it. And I just really researched it and just fell in love with everything about it. And I went to Atlanta School of Sleep Medicine. And back then they only had courses for anyone interested in sleep as well as a physician. So we were basically all learning at the same time.
Okay. Well, take me through the process. My doctor says, I'd like you to have a sleep study. So what happens when I get there?
Okay. What happens is, and it's very important, I do want to say, if you have any problems staying awake during the day, if you feel fatigued, if you have unexplained weight gain within, you know, like the last year or two, whatever it may be, always talk to your physician, because that's kind of like a key for them to even recommend to you about a sleep study. So you can either talk to your doctor about, I would like a sleep study, or give your doctor information so they can make that judgment call to get you scheduled for a sleep study. So what happens is your general practitioner, your nurse practitioner, PA, whoever you see, will make a order, send an order over to the scheduling at Aspirus, and we have a group that actually does scheduling. And our sleep specialist, Dr. James Saigan, he is also our medical director. He will review the patient's information and then make recommendations on what we do in the sleep lab. And he also is very in tune to insurances. So that's a good thing. So the, you don't have to worry about your insurance. They will do all of that.
So not every sleep study is the same. It's tailored to a specific patient.
Yes, yes, it is. And we basically start off the same, but okay. You won't end up the same. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's all has to do with what we see at night.
Okay.
And the doctor will say, you know, well, then this insurance company requires this, Medicare requires this. Mm-hmm. So there's different guidelines, and he's very aware of that.
So once I get there, I bring my pajamas, mm-hmm. and I get into my pajamas, and what, I just lay down and go to sleep, or what happens then?
Okay, what happens is we definitely want people to eat within 3 hours of going to bed. We've had people bring full meals and then think this is, you know, it's going to be a party. they come, they get in their PJs, and now we're going to have supper. Well, it's a bad thing to eat within 3 hours of bedtime, number one. So we kind of really ask you to refrain from that. Eat before you come. But bring something comfortable to sleep in. If you take any sleep aid, muscle relaxer, pain pills, please bring those with you and take them when you get there. Do not drive with those mm-hmm. medicines in your system, but your other medicines you're welcome to take before if you want. You come and we talk to you and we do a little bit of education as well, you know, finding out what's going on. And that gives us an idea of what we're going to see during the night. Yes.
So you put some sensors on the body, and what do they measure? Is it brain waves, heart rate? What are you looking at?
Actually, it's all of the above that you mentioned. We want to see what's going on with the brain. We want to see what kind of activity occurs. We want to see if you ever get into deep wave sleep, because we're a sleep deprived society. You know, we're over 60% obese in the country, and a lot of that is associated with not getting enough sleep. So we monitor your muscle, because a lot of people have that restless leg syndrome, periodic limb movement syndrome, and that can be easily treated with medicine. A lot of people don't know what's going on. They just know they're fatigued. They just know they get so acclimated to feeling bad that they think it's their normal until they come and have a sleep study and then see, you know, if you have sleep apnea, et cetera, it can be, you know, fixed for you. And treated.
So, all sleep is not the same. Can you take me through the stages of sleep? What happens when I fall asleep? First, what's the first stage?
Yes, it's one, two, three, and REM. So the first stage is, you know how when you're dozing, whether you're in church or whether you're on a conversation with somebody and your eyes just want to doze off a little bit. We all do it. That's the dozing stage. It's stage one. In other words, you have the ability to either become awake or you have the ability to go to sleep. So it's the first transitional dozing kind of stage. Okay. We get only a small percent. That should be 5% of our sleep time should be in that transitional stage. When somebody tells me that, oh God, it takes me seconds or minutes to fall asleep, that's the first sign you are very sleep deprived. Because normal sleep transition occurs 15 to 20 minutes.
Okay.
And then we go into stage two, which is, it's kind of like, it's almost like getting on the highway on a ramp. You're coming on, you're going slow, and then you keep accelerating. This is kind of like how sleep goes also. So then we get 50% of our time we spend in stage two. And every stage has a purpose. Because in non-REM sleep, one, two, and three is where we restore our cells, we repair our tissues, we regenerate tissues, cells, build bones, muscle, and also strengthen our immune system. So all of this plays in how often we get sick and how our heart reacts, our brain reacts, our headaches, et cetera.
So then there's REM sleep. Is that when you're dreaming? Do you dream in REM sleep?
Okay. Yes. REM is the restorative mental restorative state of sleep. We dream and our body is actually totally paralyzed. and accept our phrenic nerve so we can breathe, and then we can have these rapid eye movements. So it's like your body is ramping up, your heart rate accelerates, your temperature goes up, and it's your body kind of like going through checkpoints to make sure everything's okay. But also you can dream in delta sleep. That's also where we get a lot of our tissue repair. I've seen through the years, there's like a 10 to 30% improvement in people with chronic pain if they can get in delta sleep and stay in delta sleep. So every stage has a purpose.
Let's talk a little bit about dreams. This is, yeah, you know, fascinating to me.
This, with me
there
too.
Are nights that I feel like I've gone to bed and I've gone to the movies. I mean, my dreams are so vivid, and I remember them when I wake up, at least for a little while, then they tend to fade. Mm-hmm. My husband, totally opposite. He almost never remembers his dreams. He feels like he doesn't dream. So do we sleep differently? Does everybody dream the same amount? And how do you know?
Yeah. Yes. And REM is a very fascinating stage of sleep. It's very intense. You can have vivid dreams. Some people dream in color. Some people dream in black and white. Some people remember dreams. Others do not. Sometimes when people do not remember dreams, and let's say they snore or they do that incredible gasping, oh gosh, I would hate to have to do it for you, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's that, you know.
Oh, I know that
and then
sound.
They gasp and wake themselves up. In that stage of sleep, that kind of is where people can have nightmares in REM, and it's the gasping, you know, so they can have different types of dreams depending on what's going on.
So when you're doing a sleep study and you're observing the patient, can you tell when they're dreaming?
Yes, and we can actually tell when they're getting ready to, because we're you know, experts on reading these brain waves, along with we monitor, gosh, 12 to 17 different leads on the body. There's face, because we're watching your eyes for when you go into REM, because, you know, if you've seen animals or babies, their eyes are very active. You know, they're in REM sleep. We also monitor your muscle, because the prevalence of the leg syndrome is very high as we get older. So we monitor that. We want to see if you're clenching your teeth. Obviously, we're in so much stress and depression, et cetera, during this time of our life and with what's going on in the world. So we get a lot of clenchers and grinders because of stress. So we monitor all different places on the body, plus your heart. We monitor the heart. There's a lot of heart influence.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When I was researching for today's program, I read that there are two main processes that regulate sleep, and one was circadian rhythms. So what are circadian rhythms exactly?
Our circadian rhythm kind of guides us through when to go to sleep. For instance, you know, like shift workers, it is so difficult to transition working nights when you're really a wren. You want to stay up during the day. You know what I mean? So it's very difficult for these people to transition to sleeping during the day because they work at night. So getting enough sleep, if you don't darken your rooms, like maybe you, there's blinds actually now that you can go from a transition between day and night blinds. You can flip it, you know, then it goes dark for you. Putting tin foil in your windows, because your circadian rhythm wants to sense night in order to put you into that situation where you go to sleep. Because light means stay awake, mm-hmm, and the darkness. Yeah.
So the darkness is a signal.
Yes, that's the purpose of the circadian rhythm.
You're listening to Tonda Nicholson on Route 51, a discussion on the science of sleep and the surprising impact sleep has on our overall health. When we return, a closer look at sleep studies and what doctors can learn from the results. You can join the conversation too by calling 800-780-9742 or email questions to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And clover, then tell him that my lonesome nights are over.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Tonda Nicholson, a polysomnographic technologist from Aspyrus, is here today as we continue our discussion on the science of sleep. Do you have questions for our guest? Join the conversation. Call us at 800-780-9742. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. Or you can email us at route51@wpr.org. So, Tonda, what are some of the reasons that a doctor would prescribe a sleep study?
I have actually had physicians say, I need this patient to have a sleep study. They fell asleep during our appointment visit. So, wow. Yes. And if a patient is on 1, 2, and actually sometimes 3 blood pressure medicines, usually there's an 85% chance it's related to sleep apnea. And a lot of times, if you can get rid of the sleep apnea, I've seen where patients through the years have been able to get off 1, 2, and sometimes all of their blood pressure medicines. Because what happens in the body, and just think about this, when you quit breathing, there's no place to pump the blood. So your heart has to slow so much. And then when you take that gasping breath, the heart has to pump so fast in order to get that blood all through your body in order to get back up to your brain and heart. So that's what causes a lot of times an enlarged heart. And get the apnea, sleep apnea fixed, your heart can go back to normal size a lot of the time. So that's just a very interesting fact of getting your doctors, the information that you feel is important to get to your doctor always, or your care practicing care practitioner who you see.
And sleep apnea, one of the most significant disorders that can be discovered during a sleep study. And I want to talk more about that in just a bit. But what are some of the other conditions and symptoms that this tests for? Like headaches, insomnia. I mean, what are you looking for other than sleep apnea?
Well, when a lot of patients, that's one of the first things I ask them is that if they have headaches in the mornings. And almost all of them always say yes. If they say yes, that is another clue that generally they're probably going to have sleep apnea. Because what happens is when you're low on the oxygen to your brain, your vessels constrict, and that's what causes the pressure buildup. And that's why a lot of people, you know, of course, there's many reasons. You have to talk to your physician about that. But one, if you have sleep apnea and we get it treated the night that you come in, almost every patient wakes up without a headache then, because the flow of blood can continue after we get the apnea straightened. And just because of what I said before, you can't pump blood to your brain and heart while you're having an apnea event. And it can last anywhere from 10 seconds all the way up to 2 minutes. And that can be very critical.
That's a long time without.
It's a very long time without breathing and getting oxygen to your organs and brain. Yes.
When you're doing a sleep study, what specifically tells you that the patient has apnea? Is it the gasping? Is there an oxygen decrease? What kind of things do you look for to diagnose that or to help with the diagnosis?
Actually, all of that, but it begins with the questionnaire that Aspyrus has. You know, our sleep center and our sleep specialist, Dr. Saigan, we have a questionnaire that gets sent out to the patient. So you bring that back in to us. We review it. And that's also just clues for us, polysomnographic technologists, when we're doing the study, just gives us some idea of what we're going to see. So once we start monitoring you, everything matters. If it takes you, some people do not get REM at all. Some people don't even get Delta. And it's because of one of the many sleep disorders that we can see. It's very prevalent to have sleep apnea because of the differences that it just keeps escalating in our society and sleep deprivation. So what we see on our tracings, which happens in 30-second pictures for us, we actually score that. And then the computer is helping us calculate it through the night. And then because of our quality in our sleep center, we even actually go through it again the next day. So we actually score these records twice to make sure our accuracy is so precise for the doctors to make the most proper recommendations for you.
So often when sleep apnea is detected, doctors then prescribe CPAP machines. Yeah. We have a question from a caller on that. But before we get to that, can you explain what a CPAP machine actually does? How does it work?
Yes. Okay. Well, just think about this. A lot of times when the airway collapses, it collapses and doesn't want to open up until you do that incredible gasp. Sometimes you know you gasp, sometimes you don't. That's why sometimes patients say, I have nightmares all the time. Well, that's another clue that they probably have sleep apnea. And it's not a sure thing, but it's something that I key in on and I'm usually aware that this is going to be what's happening. What happens is when they meet the criteria for insurance to pay for the machine, we're very sensitive into making sure that we follow these guidelines very precisely. CPAP is continuous positive airway pressure. So what happens is it's like stepping on a garden hose. You're trying to get air through a closed or a very, very small opening. So this is like our throat or our nose. So what happens is we use the CPAP because the patient can actually wake up the next morning feeling 100% or 50% different improvement just in one night. So what happens is it keeps your airway open. So what I mentioned before, the flow of blood through your body, to your brain, to your heart, and that's what keeps them from having that headache then the next morning. Even if there's something so small like that, that a patient can say, oh, you know, I hate this thing. I look like Darth Vader at night. However, I love the way I feel. And that's when they have that little bit of an aha moment. And then they're more receptive to this thing might work and really save my life. And it usually does.
Tom called. Tom is on the road, and so he wasn't able to stay on the phone, but he's listening, and he uses a CPAP machine. Tom is wondering why sometimes in the morning he feels like he's full of air and he's bloated. Do you know why that might be and how he might be able to prevent that?
Yes. Here's one thing that I would ask Tom or any of the viewers out there. When you go on CPAP, what happens is, and you start to get your deep sleep, your delta and your REM sleep. Plus, if you have to get to 7 to 8 hours of sleep, that's the main thing. But what happens is if people can lose a significant amount of weight, their pressure needs to drop. So let's just say we diagnosed you in the sleep lab and you were 275 pounds and we diagnosed you on a pressure of 12, let's just say, and then you lost 25 to 50 pounds, then that means the pressure, the problem, the blockage is alleviating. So that pressure needs to come down. If you don't have that pressure come down or you don't talk to your healthcare provider and say, you know what, I'm not feeling as good. I'm getting distended. That's called distension. And what happens, like Tom said, is probably he's lost weight and his pressure is too high. So by bringing that pressure down, you'll get that recommended air to go into your trachea instead of too much going into your esophagus at the same time. You see what I mean? And Actually, it can be so painful, but it's like a distension.
And so this is something
Tom is feeling. Yes.
Okay. So this is something that can be fixed, but he's going to need to have that recalibrated. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. What about patients who can't tolerate a CPAP machine? Are there other options available?
Yes, there is. Now, CPAP, because it can be an instantaneous, it can take anywhere from when you wake up in the morning to 2 weeks. The longest I've ever seen anyone having trouble adjusting is probably a month, but it takes a little time. But if the people can just stick with it. And one thing I really want to stress to the viewers is by insurance guideline, they say 4 hours is good enough and we'll buy this machine for you. But in sleep medicine, if you don't sleep 7 to 8 hours a day, you'll never feel good. So you will think it's not working. You see what I mean? So because CPAP is the first line of treatment for anyone with sleep apnea, that will be the first choice. Mm-hmm. If you cannot tolerate the pressure, insurance companies, they don't care if you're claustrophobic. That doesn't matter. You can have a BiPAP machine that has a dual, you breathe in, you blow out with a more relaxed pressure. Mm-hmm. Then we have another machine that if you have central apnea, that happens with a lot of heart issues. That is a machine that's very smart that operates on its own. If somebody has just snoring, but really severe snoring and very little apnea, like less than 10 events an hour, a lot of times mouthpieces are very effective. So we can, you know, there's places to fit you with a proper mouthpiece. And that's an option.
Okay.
And sometimes if somebody is really, really obese and they absolutely refuse CPAP, then a lot of times the doctors will recommend possible a trach, which is a hole in your throat at night to, you know, bypass. It bypasses the obstruction, which is your upper airway.
What does sleep have to do with weight gain or weight loss? You mentioned this a couple of times in our conversation so far about how if you've had unexpected weight gain, this could be a signal that you've got something going on with your sleep. What's the relationship there?
The relationship is sleep deprivation. A lot of people, you know, I mean, we're trying to fly by with as little sleep. I've heard a lot of people say, yeah, I don't sleep a lot because I'll sleep when I die. Well, that might be earlier than expected if you don't get enough sleep. But basically, we have two hormones that are responsible for decreasing our appetite. They're appetite suppressants during the day. They're called leptin and ghrelin. And they're mainly secreted during deep wave sleep, which is your delta sleep, stage 3, right before you go into REM. Well, if you're cutting yourself short, the majority and the most intense REM and delta sleep occurs between 4 and 6 in the morning. Now, that's based on normal guidelines. And so what happens is when we sleep less than 7 hours a day, we bypass that. So I have patients tell me, you know, I go to the refrigerator, I go to the vending machine, and I don't even know why I'm there. Well, it's your body and brain trying to do anything to stimulate you to stay awake.
Okay.
You see what I mean? So
yes. What about the relationship to other health conditions like high blood pressure and migraines?
Oh, I mean, it's related. You know, a lot of people could be, you know, and like I said, I'm not a physician. Always talk to your physician. But a lot of people, the headaches that you experience because of sleep apnea and not getting that blood to your brain causes very severe headaches. And because of that, they can be treated as migraines when actually it's due to the untreated sleep disorder. Or you can also get headaches from grinding due to the stress and
what's
going on. Yes.
Sure. I have a friend who's really struggling with insomnia. She has been struggling with it for months now. Do we know what causes insomnia?
Well, there's multiple reasons. It could be if you have insomnia that happens less than 30 days, that can be associated with, let's say you're going through a divorce, you know, you've had a loss of, you had a death, a loss of job. A lot of times those are insomnias that can last like 30 days or a little bit longer. Always talk to your healthcare member to let them know what's going on. Sometimes therapy, seeing a psychologist to work through those. A lot of times also I see, and I won't ask you your friend's age because that's not appropriate, but 40 to 60 year old women, sometimes our hormones, because we have a little bit of progesterone, and sometimes when our progesterone gets depleted or extremely low, that's what helps promote sleep. for women. I don't know is if your friend's a woman or a man.
Okay, yeah, she's a woman, and she's in that category. She's in that age range. Yeah. So thank you. That's very helpful. Yeah. I'm also curious.
Yes. Professional to maybe check your hormones, or there's a trial of progesterone that actually a lot of women use, and 10-15 minutes and you're sound asleep like a baby.
Okay.
Because it promotes sleep. Yes.
What about sleepwalking? Why do some people sleepwalk? And I mean, do we know, is there anything that can be done about it?
Yes, actually sleepwalking is very fascinating. It usually does happen. It's a parasomnia. It's in a whole different category than the sleep apnea and stuff. But the sleepwalking can occur, and it can also go away depending on your age. A lot of times it's due to lack of sleep. And the only time it gets to be a big issue, I mean, okay, you left the refrigerator door open. You've got food all over the cupboards. You don't remember doing that, you know. That can be more aggravating than troublesome. But I had a patient years ago that actually was in his undergarments, walking out the door and getting into his car. Oh. And he was a young college student. And luckily, it woke his father up, and his father went out to get him. But you can actually do this acting out with things that, you know, like is everyday life, but you don't even realize you're doing it. So an old remedy was, if you got a sleepwalker, whether it's a child or a teenager or an adult, if you tie some cans, string on some cans and hang it on the door and shut their door at night, when you hear that rattle, that means you get up and find out what's going on. But
that's got to be so unnerving. Absolutely.
It can be a dangerous thing. People have gotten hurt by sleepwalking. That's when you really, really need to find out, is there a medicine out there that can kind of block you out of that stage of sleep? Like if it blocks you out of delta, it usually increases your REM. Blocks you out of REM, it'll increase your delta. So you can dream in both of those stages. So, and they're both restorative to our body and our mind, but, you know, they kind of beat to their own drum just a little bit. But that's what happens with sleepwalking. A lot of times it alleviates on its own.
Okay. You're listening to Tonda Nicholson today on Route 51, talking about sleep studies, how they're administered, and what they can tell us about our overall health. When we return, a look at ways to improve sleep, and we'll welcome your questions too. You can call us at 800-780-9742 or email us at route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Be my pillow, take my hand, and let me sleep in the coolness of your shadow, in the silence of your deep.
When I wake up early in the morning, lift my head, I'm still yours.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Tonda Nicholson is here today for a discussion on sleep, what happens to our brains and bodies while we slumber, and what our sleep can tell us about our overall health and well-being. We'll take your questions, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. When calling us, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. Or you can email us, too, route51@wpr.org. Tonda, this has been such a difficult year. So many reasons. I mean, it's the stress of the coronavirus pandemic. With all of this, are you seeing more sleep disruption, more sleep disorders than you have in the past?
Yes, actually, unfortunately, all of it. And what we're seeing also is that the lack of sleep, because it is so important to our immune system, there's a protein in our bodies that gets secreted during the deep wave sleep. And I always go back to that deep wave sleep. And the most intense is that seventh and eighth hour of sleep. This is how important for our overall health, our longevity of health, that we hit 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And the reason why is because our immune system, our metabolism is the proteins that strengthen our immune system are secreted during that deep wave sleep. And because of that, the COVID patients and the worrisome and everything that we're worried about, the jobs, the families, the lack of connection with people causes lack of sleep. We need to keep a regular regimen as much as we can. That's what's really important. And we need to find whatever way possible. White noise, light noise, placescapes, change your room around to have a sleep ambience to make it very comfortable. Sleep cool is another thing. The blue light that we have with TVs on, computers on, especially for our young people, because they're having probably the most difficult time because they are so disengaged with society. Not, the schools have changed, the friends, you know what I'm saying? We cannot stay connected. So people are, I think, more apt to go to their social media. And sometimes I've had people leave it on. The kids tell me they leave it on. The phones are still on because they're just fearful of that connection. And it's really causing a lot of sleep issues within our entire society.
So you talk a lot about needing that 7-8 hours of sleep. You've got to get enough sleep. That's kind of the magic amount, it sounds like. But what about childhood sleep? How long should a child sleep? Do they need more sleep than an adult does? Or,
oh, absolutely. Newborns, here's what's the biggest problem with a lot of children. When a lot of children, they cry and they're fussy, and then you end up holding them because it seems like it's a comforting feature. Newborns 0 to 3 months need 14 to 17 hours of sleep. And infants from 4 to 11 months need 12 to 15 hours of sleep. Toddlers, 1 to 2-year-old, 11 to 14 hours. And then it keeps decreasing. Preschool, 3 to 5, 10 to 13 hours. School age, 6 to 13, 9 to 11. And then when you start to become a young adult, age 18 all the way up to as old as you possibly can, 7 to 9 hours is normal.
So do you have any tips for getting a child to sleep through the night? I know that a lot of parents struggle with this, getting a child to sleep in their own bed.
Yes.
What's your advice there?
Well, there's multiple methods and that's up to the parent and the pediatrician to discuss it with. But, I've looked at the Ferber method. It's a quick way to get your child to self-soothe. Otherwise, they are constantly going to look to you to soothe them. It's kind of like getting your child in their own soothing to where they know if I roll over and wake, my normal routine is to cry and wake somebody up to attend to me. These little sweet bundles of joy are smarter than we think, and they can control us more than we would like them to.
Yes, yes.
And then we put speakers in our bedroom sky high so we can not miss their little yelping, at night. And that's a bad thing. I think that's a bad thing. I mean, years ago, doctors would say, if a child wants you, they're going to let you know. In other words, they really escalate the crying. So I really like the Ferber method because it can be as short as 2 days or it can take up to a week. And that's actually not a lot of sacrifice to get your child's sleep switched around. And here's something I really, really want to stress to parents. Your child's growth hormones are secreted during delta wave sleep, the stage 3 sleep. And you are doing a detriment to your child if you are not engaged in making sure they get the correct amount of sleep that I mentioned before on that specific age. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
The growth hormones are very important for the children, because once they get past having over 50% of their night spent in delta sleep in that younger age, the reason why is due to those growth hormones being secreted. And that's why it's so important for them to get 14, anywhere from 11 to 17 hours a night.
Okay. We have a caller. Jim is on the line. Jim from Stevens Point. Thanks for calling. What was your question?
Good morning. I have a question about the 7 to 8 hours of sleep. So I get about, say, 6 hours, and then I wake up and I'm listening to the radio for a half an hour, and I fall back to sleep for another hour and a half, 2 hours. Is it the same for an interrupted sleep as solid sleep?
In a short interval like that, Jim, thank you for your call. It's okay because it's a shorter interval. But if you get up, let's say you get up 6 hours and you go to work, well, you won't have the best day. You might be irritable, but just staying awake for half an hour and then going back to sleep for another hour or two, there's nothing wrong with that, because sometimes it takes us that long to get up, go to the bathroom and come back to go to sleep, you know, and then fall back asleep. So that's okay.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks,
very much.
Jim.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call.
That brings me to another question. What about naps? I have a friend, but my friend and I argue about this all the time. So are naps good for us, or does it screw up our sleep pattern later in the day?
The answer is both.
Okay.
Here's the deal. If you have to take a nap, take a nap before 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Reason being, you have to keep your nap to 15 minutes to no more than a half an hour. After a half an hour, your body and brain is going to say, oh, well, we're down for the count. So it's going to start moving you forward into deep wave sleep. And that's what's going to mess you up with your nighttime sleep. And then it's like, oh my gosh, it's 10 o'clock. I can't get to sleep, you know, and I got to get up for work. And the more you worry about it, the longer it's going to take you to go to sleep. So
no 2 hour naps. No 2 hour naps.
Absolutely not. That's called sleep, Suri.
All right, I win.
So,
now, here's another question. Can you catch up on sleep? People always say, I'm going to catch up on my sleep on the weekend. My son's a good one for this. I don't sleep much during the week, but I'll catch up on the weekend. Is that a thing? Does it work?
You know, I think sometimes the theory's out a little bit on that. However, we in the medical field, you know, working swing shifts or working very long shifts, especially this day and age, we do sleep in. And you can if it's like close to 1 or 2 days apart. But if it's last week, last month, usually once it's gone, it's gone. That's why Bruce Lee, I think it was Bruce Lee that said, time waits for no one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once it's gone, it's gone.
Right.
And that's why there was an interesting study a few years back with the NFL and the NBA. And I'll just talk about this just real briefly. What they discovered, and I believe it was one NBA team, I can't remember the name of them, and also the Patriots, Tom Brady's team when he was with the Patriots, they decided to have a rule with all of their players that you get 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night, or 8 to 9 hours of sleep a night every single night. And what they showed, and they also did blood work on rookies that still wanted to have that young life, what have you, versus older players that, you know, had injuries but slept. And what those studies showed was that the rookies that had less sleep, less than seven, because they deliberately sleep deprived them, the younger ones. Mm-hmm. And then they had a group where they definitely got that versus sleep a day. What it showed with their blood work is that the young people, the younger rookies that had less than 6 or less hours of sleep, their blood work was that of a retired older athlete.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it was very fascinating because your tissues can't repair because remember, sure. Again, REM and Delta, your last stages of sleep, the most intense, is where you're going to get your cellular repair and your tissue repair. So what the Patriots also proved was that their guys came back faster, mm-hmm. and they had less injuries.
Okay.
And I guess that's why they won how many Super Bowls?
Too many. So we have Bob on the line. Bob on the line from Stevens Point. Thanks for calling. What's your question, Bob?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I snore very loud, according to my girlfriend. So I went to the doctor, and I had a sleep apnea test done. And I passed that with no apnea, yet I'm still snoring very loud. Do any of these over-the-counter remedies, or can you suggest anything that could let us sleep together a little easier?
Yes. Hi, Bob. Thank you so much. This one is very, very important because this is, you know, and of course, without looking at your data or anything or seeing the recommendations, you have what I would probably consider snoring syndrome. Snoring syndrome alone without sleep apnea could still lead to a stroke. Now, that's information you could get from Mayo Clinic, the Academy of Sleep Medicine. It's very important because I've had patients that have actually had strokes because of just snoring untreated, or they did not want to go on the CPAP or get any treatment and had stroke and ended up coming back. But there's mouthpieces that can be extremely effective. However, anytime, and here's that catch 22. If you don't get your recommended quality sleep, now Bob, you could sleep 7 to 9 hours a day. But if you snore like you do, yes, but if you snore like you do and don't wake up feeling refreshed, that means you have to have treatment because either it could be your tonsils. Most men have had a deviated septum. You played sports, which actually is kind of like a broken nose. It causes scar tissue in the nose. You've had a fight over a girl. You know what I'm saying? Sports, wrestling with your relatives, your guys. And what happens is you can get scar tissue buildup from injury to your nose. That is a blockage. Tonsils, weight gain. So there's several things you can do. If you're overweight, get your weight off. But one thing is difficult is you can't get your weight off until you get good sleep. So talk to your physician about other remedies for just severe snores.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you very much.
One final question before we wrap here. What are some tips for getting a good night's sleep? What can we tell our listeners to do to sleep better tonight?
Yes, just very quickly, avoid caffeine. Alcohol is a stimulant. A lot of people think that, oh, it relaxes me, so I'm going to sleep good. No, it does not. It relaxes your reflexes, but it stimulates the mind, stimulates your brain. So it prevents you from getting to deep sleep. Nicotine is a stimulant. So avoid those within 3 hours of bedtime. If you have to change your room around, get better curtains in your room, make it a sleep ambience that you enjoy going to sleep. Don't watch the clock, turn it around backwards. Don't hit the snooze alarm, set it a half hour later. And there's so much other, but you can get that, how to get better, tips to get better sleep on the internet.
Thank you so much. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guest, Tonda Nicholson from Aspirus Healthcare. Our executive producer and on-air producer today is Rick Ryer. Our producer is Joy Ratch Kramer. Special music today from Metallica, The Supremes, Blondie, The Beatles, The Youngbloods, and Gary Wright. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, expect an encore program about protecting mental health during the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. And in 2 weeks, three local musicians will join us for a lively Thanksgiving special. If you have questions for our guests or an idea for a future program, email us at Route51@WPR.org. Until next week, we're heading out of town.